Hey, Brennan.
Hey, Alan.
It's another Not a Thing podcast.
Woohoo!
I know we have a theme and it says our the name of the podcast and everything, but I just like introing it. I don't know why. I'm compelled to introduce ourselves.
You're just looking out for the blind people.
Wait. Wouldn't they have heard the theme song too? If they were
blind? If they could understand the robot voice.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it is kind of worked on a little bit. We'll talk about that actually later in the episode, won't we? we have a lot of stuff to cover, a lot of ground to cover, places to explore, ideas to talk about, things. So let's just jump right in. One of the things that I saw earlier last week, it was actually pretty soon after our podcast last week, was some scientists had rigged up a thing so two mice's brains were connected in such a way that they could cover the eyes of the first mouse, it sounded like, and then the second mouse would get a camera view into what was happening with the first mouse, and it would help the first mouse strictly through brainwaves to solve the puzzle to get whatever the food was. And I read this and I immediately thought, it's the Bynars from Star Trek The Next Generation. And the episode was name was like 1100110 or something like that. I'm sure there's a good-hearted Trekkie out there who will let me know what it actually was, but the premise behind the episode was that the race of people, you know, this alien race of people that had evolved or co-evolved, so they would connect two Bynars' brains together, and they would talk and interact with the world, but they would also have this kind of super fast link where they would talk to each other, and it became a thing where they would solve problems together. And it was much more efficient, supposedly, than having, like, individuality, complete individuality and stuff. And it was, you know, a neat concept for a show. It's actually very similar to the concept of extreme programming, if you've ever heard of that in computer science. So the thing with computer science, extreme programming, is you sit with another programmer when you're working on code or a problem, and one person would type, but you would both be sharing a screen. And so when it's your turn to type, you're coding, and the other person is kind of watching and thinking about what's next and coaching you through it, and then you would trade off every once in a while. And I just thought it was really funny, and, you know, I took a lot of computer science when I was in college. I just thought it was really funny that only in the world of programming is it considered extreme to work with another person. But this whole thing with the mice and the brains thing is really fascinating, and of course we'll link it in the show notes. But it has the implication is that you can connect, you know, two animals, two people's eventually brains together, or more than two, to solve kind of interesting and complex problems. And I'm not sure what to think about that. or rather, I am sure what to think about that. I think it's a bad idea.
They say two heads are better than one.
Right, but I think actually joining two heads has a lot of potential problems, and maybe more than two heads, right? I mean, I think that working on the brain is kind of a difficult thing, and maybe not the best thing to mess around with, especially for linking two people. I mean, just if the Next Generation is any indicator, it's really dangerous to do that, because if one of the Bynars dies, the other one pretty much is gonna die really, really soon. And I don't know if I'd want that you know, potential tether so
well, considering enforced. Considering how high the divorce rate in this country is, I really think that's a bad idea. That's a much bigger commitment.
And that's
than
one
getting
that
married.
Right. And in theory, marriage is one of those things where you enter into it kind of, you know, you know, like on purpose. And this seems like the kind of thing that you would do, you know, you'd have to do at birth or, you know, really, really soon so you could forge those mental pathways. And
So India is probably going to be the first country to adopt this thing. With the arranged marriages. Right. It's like, bam, your brains are linked.
Oh, they're always steps ahead of us, that country. It's... But what was really interesting also is in the news, I think just yesterday, is that scientists have revealed that they've unveiled at a conference that there's been a program to create brain computer interfaces, and they've had these for a while. I guess the article points out that there was even one that was made that helped a paralyzed woman operate a robotic arm, and so she could, you know, feed herself and get water for herself and stuff. And but it's a wired tether, so she has to be, you know, with it and nearby and stuff. And so this is the breakthrough, is that they've worked out the technology to do everything wirelessly. So you get this thing implanted into your brain, and it will wirelessly send signals. And you know, the other piece of it is you can charge it wirelessly too, because, you know, you don't want to have to like plug into a wall or whatever every. I don't know how the wireless charging thing works. I assume it's like those electric toothbrushes where you kind
of... Well, judging by the battery life of my iPod, I don't know how great an idea that is. Just using, whenever I turn on the Bluetooth, it just drains it. But then, on the other hand, you've got people who are freaking out about smart meters from PG&E.
Right.
The Wi-Fi signals are destroying our brains.
Yeah.
And then you have other people who are like, we're going to put Wi-Fi in our brains.
Yeah. Well, I guess the big deal about it is not, I mean, they haven't put them into human brains yet, or at least not the wireless ones. But they've said that they've been able to put them into animal brains, and they've, you know, successfully been implanted and not rejected or otherwise, you know, caused some extreme immune reaction for at least a year. So I mean, it was good
because lifespans are only like a year.
Well, right.
It just has to work for a year. It's like the next model of iPhone is gonna come out. Oh, I'm gonna get my new brain chip.
Oh man, I don't know if I'd want surgery every time the new iPhone comes out. I think that might cause me to delay upgrading a little longer.
Your brain OS is obsolete. We're going to have to tear that thing out.
And that's
can't
how
sync with iTunes or anything.
Right. Oh, I'm on iOS 5 and it doesn't support iOS 6. Yeah. That's not good. That would be really bad. That's another reason to maybe not implant in humans, because I think the release schedule has to be a lot more flexible, and B, they got to work on that backwards compatibility thing like crazy, I think.
I think if they do move to human trials, the scientists who are running the trials should have to be the guinea pigs. Because who else is going to volunteer to, oh yeah, put something in my brain. Go ahead.
That sounds pretty fair, actually. I think self-experimentation's probably... If movies have taught us anything, that's how things go, right? The Fly, you know. What else?
Well, well, there's a difference between self-experimentation and, you know, testing on a team. Like, you know, it's the rogue scientist that always has problems.
Right.
You need at least two henchmen. I mean, assistants.
Well, yeah, because otherwise you have the Lawnmower Man situation, which you don't want either. You know,
no.
Or Pierce Brosnan did not choose the right guy for that. That was maybe not the best plan. but I think these kinds of things, our position on the show is not maybe 100% clear, but we support almost all tech that involves stuff pulled from the next generation Star Trek or shows, right, and movies. So, I mean, in as much as I'm kind of not in favor of this technology right now, I think we'll get it. I think it's on the way and probably a good idea.
Well, you think it's a good idea, but when we're fighting at Wolf 359, I'll be the one laughing. All you suckers, put chips in your brains.
Yeah, right.
That's right. Wolf 359 reference.
Right. What if my friends, actually the guy that tweeted that story and I was able to pick it up. I wrote to him that you know, call me when, I mean, that's only two brains. Call me when the hive mind is ready, because that's when you got to be worried. But so I think another, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, like the augmentation of people's abilities, especially in kind of the sci-fi realm, is really cool. But the augmentation of people's abilities in kind of more of a superhero realm, which isn't quite the same as sci-fi, I think is also valid and interesting, because there was an article about, I guess there's this mountain in the Alps that's the Eiger, I believe it's pronounced.
Of the Eiger sanctioned fame?
Oh, is it?
I think so.
Oh, wow. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. It's not
how many Eigers
name.
Can there be?
Right. So anyway, this Alp, as it were, is like the first time people climbed it, it took 3 days. And then the next record was like 18 hours. And then the next record was like 3 hours. And this is all, you know, guys with like crazy packs and gear and crampons and like synthetic materials and stuff. And then just recently, I guess, a woman climbed it while she was pregnant. And so it's the kind of thing where it's like, is technology, how much of this is technology and how much of this is just, you know, people getting better? And I thought that was a really interesting look at it, because there was one guy that had climbed it, you know, without tools, essentially. Just free climbed. Yeah, which is nuts.
But, well, we know William Shatner can do it. We saw him do that in what was that, Star Trek V?
That was V, yes. Go climb a rock was what his shirt said. But the stuff in the article was really neat, because it talked about, you know, some of it is attributable to equipment and, you know, crazy carbon fiber and synthetic material, ice picks and whatnot, and crampons, you know, for shoes and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, portable oxygen, stuff like that. But I think what the article doesn't go into too much is that people train for this kind of thing, right? I mean, how many people were training to climb mountains in that amount of time when they were doing that? And I don't think a lot of people were. I think there's kind of a more kind of extreme like training culture or kind of hero culture almost of, you know, I want to do that, or I want to be able to do this, so I'm not just going to go do it, right? I'm going to find, you know, all the increments to get up to that level. And I think, you know, and those tools and that technology is much more accessible, right? Like I can, you know, simulate, you know, whatever it is to climb a mountain indoors and work on that. And I can simulate, you know, conditions and stuff like that. And so I think a lot of it is technology based, but I think a lot of it is just, you know,
It's specialization and training.
Right. Yep.
That didn't exist before. We've traded grit for specialization. I mean, technology has helped a lot, because if you've seen the tools that they used to climb mountains back in the day, that's insane.
Yeah.
They had a lot more grit than we have specialization.
So is that something that you think is good?
Well, I think it's lowered the technology, and the amount of data that's out there on how to do these things has lowered the bar on who is able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not. I mean, it allows if more people to achieve, if that's their dream, it's easier for them to achieve it. But I don't know. Is it part of the softening of humanity?
Yeah, I do like the idea of the, you know, the quote unquote Renaissance man, and not to make it all about, you know, men, but you know, men are pretty awesome. So we're gonna keep on this track that being broadly based and able to do, you know, lots of things is still kind of valued, but it's rare because it's easy to go down those kind of training and information rat holes and just learn about like a very specific thing and completely specialize in that direction.
Well, the fact that you and I know what a crampon is, the average person back in like the 1930s didn't know what a crampon was.
Yeah, right. It does kind of sound like an ointment or something. Take Haley's crampons for that special time of the month, ladies.
What? Oh, Jesus. The views are valid and are not shared by all people associated with the podcast.
No, that was obviously the 1890s announcer guy.
Oh, right.
You know,
sorry.
Talking,
yeah.
Talking about everything. You know,
I'd like to thank our special guest, old-timey announcers guy. Welcome to the show.
Oh, well, it's great to have you. Thanks, everyone. Okay.
Yeah, okay, that's enough time for you, sir. You're going to need to leave.
Well, yeah. I mean, the article goes through a couple other things, like how there are superhero-inspired things, and a lot of them are attainable, and we've worked with them to happen, and a lot of them are not. But I think you've really hit it on the head about, you know, specialization and training and how it's much more about focusing in that direction. I think as long as those specializations across a group of people are broadly based, then it's fine. You know,
well, for every one person climbing the Eiger in under 3 hours, there's a million fat couch potatoes who have done nothing but watch Netflix and eat Cheetos. So,
and we thank them for listening to the Not a Thing podcast.
It's like there's, you know, people are getting better, faster, stronger, but the number of people who are better, faster, and stronger is getting smaller. So the human average stays about the same.
Okay. All right, I'll go
like
with that.
You get the super specialization and training and people who are into extreme sports, and you also have the obesity epidemic. So I don't know how those are related, but...
Well, I'm sure we can probably work this out, but yeah, it's a superheroes. That's why they're super. It's because they are super kind of distinct from everybody else. Hopefully, we can, you know, we can all have some superhero power. What's your superhero power?
My superhero power?
Yeah,
is patience.
Oh wow!
I actually figured this out. I have super patience.
Okay.
I'm patient man.
my patience level has dropped precipitously. It used to be a lot higher, but that's a really good superpower.
It's a muscle. You gotta work it out, man.
Yeah, probably. Eh.
All right, what's your superpower?
My superpower is that
Google.
I remember all of the food places that are good within a drivable lunchtime from wherever I am.
So you're human Yelp man?
Something like that. Right. Because I went to lunch today and we went to San Pedro Square Market downtown San Jose. It's this like indoor kind of food mall kind of thing. And I was with a bunch of people I didn't know, and I was they invited me to lunch, so that was nice. But I was, you know, we walk in and only one of them had been there before. He was the one that recommended it. And he was asking me like, where's a good place to go? And I rattled off every place in there and the last thing I ate at each one of those places. And they asked me, how often do you come here? I'm like, once a month, maybe, and it's yeah, it's not a bad thing. You know, I'm good for lunch. I'm good for knowing where a good lunch is. That's my superpower.
Yet another reason we're good friends.
And you're very patient as I rattle all of these off.
Well, that's how superhero teams work. I mean, they all complement each other.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, let's see. What else was in the? Oh. In the kind of not so super augmentation kind of realm is another article I found this week, which isn't necessarily new information, but it's a really good distillation of a bunch of things, and specifically the kind of rise and not quite fall yet of autotune.
Not soon enough.
Yeah, right. And I think autotune is an interesting kind of thing, but I am completely not a fan of it. As someone that has sung at least semi-professionally and played music in front of people, I think it's a bummer. I think it's not I think it's completely inauthentic. I don't know, I should give you some space to talk about it.
Well, it's the thing that I come back to many times, which is moderation. Everything in moderation. There's oversaturation of the autotune market.
So I agree with that. I mean, I think the autotune, when it's used very clearly, like we're autotuning this, like T-Pain or you know, the or the what is it, or a lot of like Kesha's music, if you can call it that, is very clearly auto-tuned and very obviously auto-tuned. And there are people that are, I'm sure, using auto-tune, you know, ironically, which I hate those people, because people that do things too ironically, I think, are lame. But that's a whole other topic. My thing is, what about auto-tuning where it's just used to kind of clean up a performance and, you know, in theory, not so heavily, you know, or obviously, you know, kicked on.
Still. Yeah, not everyone's cut out to be a musician.
So should those be allowed to use
it? Should, I mean, everybody should be allowed to podcast. Everybody should be allowed to podcast, but making music, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. I'm not auto-tuning this, by the way.
We could do an auto-tune episode.
Ooh, wow, that would be
terrible. The like, shortest, pretend I didn't say that.
Right, the shortest listen to episode ever. So I, you know, I think it's funny, right? Our theme song has some potentially auto-tune kind of sound in there. I'm
but
not
that's
sure.
Stylistic.
Right. And I think that kind of thing is, like I've said, it's sparing. If it's used sparingly, it's fine. And I think it's even somewhat okay for recording purposes, because you do want that recorded, you know, sound. If, you know, having that produced sound is something that some people like.
Yeah, and it depends on the music too, because right. Some music you don't want it to sound overproduced.
Right. Live music especially, or you know, certain kinds of music, right? And hopefully they're not
like overproduced punk music kind of sucks.
It's not very punk rock. I agree.
No.
using an auto-tune is like the antithesis of punk rock.
You're not a garage band, you are garage band.
But that being said, the article is really good for calling out a couple different kinds of kind of voice manipulation, which I had always I'd been somewhat aware of, and I know a lot of people kind of lump all of these into autotune, but like there's the talk box, which is the Peter Frampton kind of effect, if you've ever heard it, and
which can be used well.
Yeah, and that one's done like the most analog way possible. There's essentially a tube which runs from the speaker into the person's mouth, and then the sound is kind of played through that person's mouth and then echoed back out to the real speaker. I mean, it's, I think it's great, but it's the kind of thing where it's like, or we can put it through a computer. So everything is digital nowadays, and you know, I'm sure that that can be, that can be done electronically too. But the, that's been around since the well, it's probably been around longer than, you know, the early 70s, but that's when that kind of sound kicked in. And then there's vocoding, which is similar to auto-tuning, but it's the sound is different and distinct on its own. So it was a cool article, if only to pick up those pieces and kind of compare them. I like stuff like that for and this is kind of going into a different direction, but I like genre kind of explaining things. You know, there was an electronica website I found a while ago that showed all the different families of electronica and how they evolved from each other, and then had, you know, 5-second clips of each of them, and it was great. So it's like, oh, now I know the difference between acid house and trance.
And I am not sure I need to know that.
Well, anyway, those kinds of things I like. Maybe we'll link it. We'll see. So I think that actually is most of the meat and potatoes of what we had to say.
Or this, no week, potatoes, because they're not primal.
No, I'm actually on, you know, I'm back to eating some kind of grains and carby foods again, but just, you know, I'm still kind of mostly staying away from them. It's been good. I don't think I talked about it on the show, but I know I talked about when I was doing the Primal Month, or mm-hmm. the whole 30 month, yeah. When I was doing the 30 days of absolutely no grains and no alcohol, you know, as a matter of course. I ended up losing like almost a tenth of my body weight. And then I gained 2/3 of that back like the next weekend. So, you know, moderation, right?
So moderation, it's like having a baby, but in reverse. You gain the weight afterwards, and you lose like a tenth of your body weight.
It's something like that, yeah. I'm not going to equate it to that, only because my sister is going to have a baby soon, and she would probably want to kill me. She probably wants to kill me now for even mentioning that on the air, but that's fine. It's not on the air. It's a podcast.
Well, hey, after a month of not drinking, I'm sure there were a lot of people you wanted to take out.
Yeah, she had 9 months of not drinking, so.
Oh, yeah.
It's only fair. But anyway, wow.
Much stronger.
That went off a little while. But yeah, it was a good experience, but I'm happy to have had a scotch already today. So let's just put it that way.
Nice.
So the other bits of stuff happening over the weekend is in San Jose, the Cinequest film festival kicked out, and it's the it's mostly indie films, and I saw a few of those. And then they have a partnership with Sony this year, and they are bringing along a few 4K restored films. So of the indie films we saw, I think it was, my favorite was, and I saw three, and I'm actually not going to talk about the two that I didn't like, because I think that's kind of mean to kick a...
To say they're not a thing?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just gonna talk about the one I did like, which was, I want to say, directed by the same director as Billy Elliot. The movie is called Hunky Dory, and it's set in the 70s, and it's a drama teacher who's trying to put on a rock opera, like you do, and it's The Tempest, but involved with like David Bowie songs and stuff like that. And it's, I thought it was a good movie. It ended up being, you know, it's a musical. And I'm inherently biased towards musicals, but it was good. And, you know, they got the style right. They got the look right. And it was, a little overwhelming at first because it's in Wales, so their accent is a little thick. But you know, by 15-20 minutes in, you're just hooked on all the characters. The only recognizable character or actor in it was Minnie Driver, at least to me, and I thought it was good. So, you know, if that's on a film festival circuit near you, check that out. Otherwise, it might get U.S. distribution. It was good. It might get like small theater distribution. So, I like that.
It'll show up on Netflix in a few months, probably.
Yeah, probably. So the other film that I saw that was great was the restored film. So they restored a bunch of films in 4K. And for those that don't know what 4K is, we'll have a quick...
Listen to the 4K episode.
Can we tell people what 4K is? Is that a... Is that
we already talked about it in a previous episode.
Oh, okay, good. So yeah. So 4K, so it's... 4,000 almost lines of resolution, right? It's like 3,800 by 2,000 or some crazy number. Anyway, they actually scan it at 8K. So they scanned the film at 8 times the resolution, or I forget. There's like a very high number of pixels. They scan the film, and then they had to go through and digitally like remove artifacts and otherwise clean it up. As far as I know, they didn't do any color correction, which is my general kind of pet peeve around restoring films. But they showed a before and after of just the scratches in the film, the dust in the film. And one interesting thing that they talked about was that when they were shooting it, just the heat, the extreme heat, because they were in the desert, would cause the film to expand during the day and then contract at night. And what that does is it forms cracks that can exhibit as, they call them columns of light. And you get this like just light column in the middle of the film or just off center. And it runs through like the whole scene, and that it runs through all the film that they used, because all of that film like was expanding and contracting at the same rate or whatever. And it's really fascinating. I mean, they said it took something like 6 months just to scan the film. Not even to start cleaning it up, just to scan the film. It took 6 months. And then another 2 years, I think, of frame by frame restoration. The movie that they did, or the movie that I saw, they released a couple more, but the movie that I saw was Lawrence of Arabia, which is it 220 minutes or something like that?
It is the, when people say things are epic, this is an epic movie.
Yeah.
Like in the truest sense of the word.
Right.
In the appropriated for the 21st century way the word is used.
Yeah, the movie up to the first intermission is 2 hours, and then it's another 80 minutes after the intermission. I mean, there's shots that I don't even know how you begin to shoot something like that. I mean, they're out in the desert. The camera is so far off, and you see like the two blips of camels that are walking in the distance, and they kind of come towards the camera over the hill. And if this was not a single shot, they must have like had to pick everything up and move, because there's no way that you could have gotten that far away from something and not leave, you know, the trail of your car tires, or, you know, the imprints of the camels walking or whatever. I mean, there are shots that are have the mirage in them, and like the person coming into frame through the mirage, and this is not like a digital effect. This is
no, they no CGI. Stood out
in the desert and played with the distance until they could see they couldn't see the person, and then brought them into frame. It's just like it's amazing to, I mean, visually stunning, really great. And then to add to it, the orchestral soundtrack and score are just amazing. I mean, they restore that as well, which is fabulous. But the main theme for Lawrence of Arabia, you might have heard it in
everything.
Least two or three other movies that I can name that that they've kind of appropriated it for just for effect. So it's a really just, you know, epic movie. I mean, that's really the best way to describe it.
It's just Peter O'Toole at his greatest.
Yeah, that's actually his first film.
It started strong.
It was introducing Peter O'Toole. I'm like, oh my god, that was great. Yeah, there's some big names in it too, besides Peter O'Toole, like
Alec Guinness.
Yeah, playing
is it Faisal?
Yes, Prince Faisal, the head of the Arab League.
Obi-Wan Kenobi is an Arab guy.
And there are some great lines about you know, protectionism and the role of you know, the conqueror and stuff like that, because it's set in World War I, you know, Arabia, as it were. It's not obviously a place anymore, but it's the Middle East, and you know, that's, it's obviously still kind of a big deal now.
Right? No, there's still definite historical relevance,
yeah,
of the movie to today's world.
Yeah, it's a really great film, and it's an investment of time to
see. So if you've got 3.5 hours to kill.
So the interesting thing is, I guess they're doing this because it was just restored and going to be released on Blu-ray, which is not 4K. Blu-ray is still just technically like just shy of 2K from a resolution standpoint. So what was shown in the theater was just amazing and probably not duplicable at home for
a little while. That's one of those movies where if you have the opportunity to see it in the theater, see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do what you have to do, because it's great to see on home viewing, but it's, you don't get the whole picture.
Right. Yeah, and
the grand scale.
The other movies that they're doing are, I don't remember the second one, but the other one that I wanted to see was Doctor Strangelove.
Oh, I would watch that.
That would probably be pretty good.
And that's one of my favorite all-time movies.
Yeah, and that's interesting, you know, because it's a black and white movie, so the amount of stuff that they have to work on with those. I mean, you would think it would be easier because there's, you know, it's not color, but I think not having the color makes you appreciate the contrasts in black and white films more, and you'll mm-hmm. see stuff like, you know, that is, you know, this is black and this is not black, and you know, that kind of stuff pops out a lot more. At least when I watch those films, it's really great for like film nerds. It's a really great experience for that, because you know, not having any film kind of artifacting at all, just, you know, there's still the original film grain, kind of, they haven't suppressed that, but it's not in any way you know, doctored, thankfully. I think that was my big worry with, you know, the restoration of films and stuff, is that there can be, you know, some. So, a quick anecdote. So I worked at a company where they would do dental modeling in 3D, and they had a bunch of people that their job was to just like clean up the images, because when you scan something in 3D, there's sometimes like artifacts from, you know, reflections or whatever, and so they would just take out all the big things, but their tools were really fine, and sometimes they would go through and like clean the tooth, essentially, like too much. And it was this, so there were these signs in the room that I saw when I was there, and I had no idea what there was for, but it was explained to me that if you were spending too much time doing that, it was called, you were smoothing, and what you were supposed to be doing was roughing and, you know, just cleaning up the big things. So there are these big signs that say no smoothing just on everything. And you know, again, it's that level of overproduction, right? You can overproduce something, and I think when you're restoring a film, you really have to be careful to not, you know, put your steal own mark the soul. On it. Right. Right. Yes. Don't take a picture of the film.
Wait, what?
That was the thing in Lawrence of Arabia, the one.
Yeah.
I think it was the sheikh that was played by Anthony Quinn. He didn't want his picture taken because he thought it would steal part of his soul.
Right.
Anyway, that was great, and I gladly would have sat for another, you know, few hours to watch that movie again. It was really good. There was one person who during the on-track, the overture after the intermission, who had their phone on, and I considered throwing something at them, like
a brick.
Yeah, but they someone next to them shushed them. You know, it was after maybe, I don't know, it felt like 5 minutes, but it was probably only like 10 seconds. Using
ten
your phone,
seconds too many.
Using your phone in a theater, not a thing.
If I have a brick nearby, I will throw it at you. People are just lucky that I usually don't see bricks laying around a movie theater. But
for your safety and the safety of others, please do not store bricks into the theater. Oh, but anyway, yeah, that was my film experience this weekend. That was nice.
Well, my film experience this weekend was more watching older movies. Mm-hmm. Not quite to the caliber of the movie you saw. I finally watched the last couple James Bond movies that I had not seen.
Okay.
So I've now finished all 23 official Eon-produced movies.
Awesome.
And awesome. I followed that up by watching the Everything or Nothing, the Untold Story of 007 documentary that they made for the 50th anniversary.
Oh, cool.
And it was a nice way to kind of cap it off. It's on Netflix. I recommend it to anyone who likes Bond. It's interesting.
Oh, that reminds me. The story. Sony did this because they were releasing Lawrence of Arabia on Blu-ray, and I know that the Bond films all just came out on Blu-ray like just a little bit ago.
Yes, they did, and it's like $150. So.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to, you know, sponsor that for the podcast, that would be pretty awesome.
Well, you know, as I finished it up, the last one I hadn't seen was License to Kill, the second Timothy Dalton movie.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I need to see that on Blu-ray. Or see that, like, ever again. Never say never again.
Ooh, ouch. Oh, poor. I don't know if that's included in the set. It shouldn't be.
Oh, Never Say Never Again would not be included.
Right. Right.
And if you watch the documentary, you will know why.
That's interesting, because that wasn't the first one I saw, but it was maybe the second one I saw. And I didn't know that it was, you know, its storied past or whatever. My dad was just like, well, it's got James Bond in it, and that's Sean Connery, so we're going to watch it. Yeah, it was not as good, let's just say. Not as good, but I'm a big James Bond fan. I mean, I remember watching my first one. My first one was it was a Roger Moore one. It was For Your Eyes Only. That's what it was.
Oh,
that's the one in the Alps, I believe. And there's a downhill ski chase, and they go through at one point. He jumps onto a bobsled course and catches up to a bobsled while on skis, being chased by a guy on a motorcycle with machine guns mounted to the motorcycle. Of course.
Because on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I also watched this week, there's a bobsled chase scene with a bobsled chasing another bobsled.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. So that's a fine George Lazenby vehicle, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, fine is a word. It wasn't as bad as I was expecting.
Yeah. A lot of people...
Everyone has said terrible things about it, but you know, right. If you watch the all the Roger Moore movies, it's not that bad. Lazenby is not a terrible Bond.
Right. I actually agree with you. I think Honor Majesty's Secret Service was quite good. If I'm remembering right, the Bond girl in it was Emma Peel from The Avengers. Am I doing that right?
I don't think so.
No? Darn it. Anyway, it's one of those things I have to look up. I have to watch all 23 movies now. Thank you for giving me an excuse. Please, someone out there, buy me or us for the podcast the Bond movie set on Blu-ray. It would be great.
Do you have a favorite Bond movie?
I think...
Or a few favorites?
I
because there's probably a lot to choose from. It's hard to choose one.
I probably do. I mean, I think I'm a real big fan of the Daniel Craig Bond movies, or at least
two of them.
Yeah, Quantum of Solace.
Not so much.
Needs a little work, but Casino Royale was wonderful, and Skyfall was just really well done. Really well done as a, and we've talked about Skyfall. I don't have to go wax on about that a lot. But I think my favorite one is maybe Diamonds Are Forever.
Really?
Which is one of the last ones with Sean Connery, if not
the last. It was the last official, and it was after he had left and come back.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of, like, we're in Las Vegas and it's this, like, seedy kind of setup, and the stuff with Mr. White and all that stuff was good. I mean, the thing that's a little, that's less good about it are the two kind of weird...
The weird henchmen?
Yeah. Who aren't, like, henchmen for the bad guys. They're just kind of in there and don't like Bond. It's just really memorable to me, and I liked the flow of that one. I don't know. What Bond film are you thinking of?
It's hard for me to choose, but it's got to be either Goldfinger or Thunderball.
Oh, well, Goldfinger is excellent, and... And Thunderball is also really good. I do like all of the Sean Connery ones, for sure.
Yeah, no, those ones are all good. It's the Roger Moore ones. Really... And even The Living Daylights is not bad. It's a pretty good movie.
No, I agree. I really like Timothy Dalton as an actor, and Timothy Dalton as a Bond, I thought was good. I just thought that the writing around his two movies were not good. Mainly the bad guys for Timothy Dalton, because both the bad guys were running drugs, essentially, right? In Living Daylights, they're trying to do a drugs for arms thing with the Russians, and Afghanistan, actually, if I'm remembering right.
Yes, it is. James Bond fights with the Mujahideen,
right?
Which is now historically awkward.
It's kind of crazy. And then in License to Kill, they're using, like, I forget, they were hiding cocaine in gasoline, if I'm remembering right.
Yes, cocaine and gasoline, and they use this, like, religious spiritual cult as the front.
Yeah, centered around Wayne Newton.
Yeah, Wayne Newton. that's right. With Robert Davi as the bad guy.
Yeah.
And young Benicio del Toro.
Right, Benicio del Toro in a... Oh, I think I saw that, and then I saw Usual Suspects. So I only thought of Benicio del Toro as this, like, really just, I don't know, just not understandable guy. Anyway. There's so many things wrapped up in Bond films for me. It's you know, just pure escapist glee. It's totally the, you know, the adolescent fanboy like sweet spot for, you know, for action and tech and girls. It's just great. I hope they make them for another
50 years.
Yeah. 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 I'm a big fan of the Bond films. I'm really glad that they got their footing again after, really after Quantum of Solace.
Well, you know, if you put Quantum of Solace up against some of those Roger Moore movies, and even some of the Pierce Brosnan movies, it's not terrible. I mean, it is terrible, but comparative to the whole spectrum of Bond movies, there are worse ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, have you seen Octopussy? There's a 00 agent dressed as a clown, and Bond hides in a gorilla suit.
Right.
Like, what? That's not right.
Yeah. That was pretty bad. Oh. Okay, I think maybe... Oh, this was one of those two... Yeah, I can think of two fun anecdotes from, like, old school Bond was... I want to say it's from Russia with Love, but it might have been Dr. No. There was... No, it wasn't Dr. No, because they weren't using the Bond theme song in Dr. No yet. But in... From Russia with Love, there's a scene where he's like sweeping the room for bugs, and the big
theme song.
Yeah, the big theme song is playing, and it's so loud that it's like if you're looking for bugs,
and he's like looking in lamps and shit.
Right, it's the most theme inappropriate use of that, but I'm so glad that theme kind of persisted because it's really completely iconic for the film. And then
Quint from Jaws was in that one too.
Yeah,
he was great.
And then my other favorite thing is in From Russia with Love when they're on the train, and the way that Bond tells that the British agent that he was supposed to meet is actually a Russian spy, is that he orders red wine with fish, and it's like the kind of thing where it's like, oh, I'm never going to make that mistake. Not that I'm, you know, a Russian spy or anything, right?
Right.
Tovarish, right? We're all good.
Right.
Anyway. Oh, man. I do want to watch a Bond film now. That's I might have to see if I can find one. I know I have one or two lying around. So
I found some on the interwebs. They do exist.
Excellent. Well, we'll probably we'll have some stuff to talk about next week. We'll see how that goes.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
Until then.
Sounds good. See you later, Brendan.